Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of NatureNow at kptz.org.
Hi, this is Mary Robson at Nature Now. For the last week in August, and everybody in this program is saying, why? So I'm glad we always consider September to be a summer month around here. I think we're going to have some beautiful warm days and some cooler ones, but it is not going to be August anymore. This week, we are going to share the bird world with Christy Lassen, owner with her husband Mark of Wild Birds Unlimited in Gardner. Christy brings her fascination with birds to how she observes them, and every time I talk with her, she has brought new research to enliven the topic at hand. Today, we will be talking about molting, strange term, why and how it happens. First, of course, we will have a mystery sound, which we will toss in right here. So, hi, Christy.
Hi, Mary.
Hi. Molting. I thought when we started, I don't really have a clear sense of the whys and wherefores of molting. I know that some animals, other than birds, lose their fur or their whole skin, as with snakes, which have outgrown their skin, or an animal like a lobster needs to shed its skin to get more room to grow, and a lot of times just unneeded fur gets too thick and has to be shed. But the most important molts, as I can tell, are those of birds, because without molting, their survival would be threatened. So where can we start to consider birds molting?
Molting is feather loss, but we don't often see birds looking naked from their molt. Birds tend to be a little more secretive and less active while they're molting, so we don't often see them in that condition. Molting is a replacement of all or some of the feathers on their bodies.
And the question is then, how does it work and what types of molts? I mean, let's say I'm an ocean-going duck or a bird that needs to molt. How does it work? What are the types of molts?
It's really interesting because different types of birds molt differently. There's basically three different types of moltings that birds can do, and different species do different types. There's one type of molt that is one complete molt per year, and it's the molt where birds replace all of their feathers on their entire body, and it usually occurs after breeding, and it's an annual event for birds. Many large birds do this. Birds that need to maintain their flights while molting undergo a pattern of molting, of feather loss. It's called remix, pattern replacement. And the remix is a word that means the primary or secondary quill feathers on the wing of a bird. Big birds that need to maintain their flight, like eagles, ospreys, the big hawks are blue-toe hawks, cormorants, herons, they molt in this pattern where they can still fly. There's also some smaller birds that do this same type of molting, including chickadees, flycatchers, hawks. Our hummingbirds molt this way, the jays, the owls, swallows, thrushes, vireos, and woodpeckers. It seems like a lot of them, but there's a lot of different types of birds out there too. And so there are different types of molts for different types of birds.
And yep. In this case, we have been talking about the one molt per year, generally after breeding is over, because obviously you need to look as sharp as possible if you're going to be in breeding.
Yes.
And that these are the birds that cannot exist if they happen to lose too many feathers to fly. In other words, they're going to lose all their, they're going to replace their feathers, but they're going to do it in a sequence that keeps them able to fly.
Yes, absolutely. Ducks and geese are a species of birds that molt one time of year as well, but they molt in different patterns than our songbirds and the bigger raptors. They lose a majority of their flight feathers each season when they molt. They become quite vulnerable at that time too, because they're unique in their molting patterns. The way it works for water fowl is that they molt their flight feathers or primaries. They don't go under what is called a sequential molt. Their flight feathers are not lost one at a time. Waterfowl undergo a simultaneous wing molt. They lose almost all of their primary feathers at once, which renders them flightless for about 20 to 40 days.
So at that point, they're extremely vulnerable.
Yes.
I mean, they're basically stuck. They can't take off.
They can't fly during this time.
Okay.
The thing that's interesting about the waterfowl is that they're very well adapted to their survival because of the habitat that they live in. It is a habitat where they can get into water away from predators. They don't necessarily have to fly when they are in danger. So they can get into the water. They can get away from danger. They can find food in those areas. They can find shelter in those areas without the immediate need to fly. So they're pretty well adapted with that to where they live and how they molt.
And the fact is that these are the adult birds who are replacing their primary feathers, right?
Yes.
If the bird's a fledgling, that's not even on the list. This is about the ones who are adults and have gotten themselves to a certain stage of life. They've gone through breeding, and then they're going to continue somehow to graze. Do they ever just stay on land and wander around?
Geese do. It seems that more geese tend to stay in field areas and graze on land. You know how we see so many of the Canada geese out in the big pasture lands?
Right.
A lot of times they're grounded for periods of time because of their molt. So I know that there are juveniles around at this time. They are probably going through their first molt, though, into their adult plumage so that they can be part of migration as well, which is an interesting thing, too. So everybody sort of stays together, the flocks of them, the juveniles with the parents, and everybody's growing new feathers all at once.
Wow. It's really astonishing to think about it because it's not something that we as bird watchers can actually observe. I mean, we may know it's going on, especially because of the timing of the season. But with the waterfowl in relative safety, some of the ones that we see in the winter, like trumpeter swans, are breeding in Alaska. They would have to do some molting after that before they fly down here. Whoa.
Absolutely.
I am wondering who keeps the timing for all of this, because it's really amazing. So there are
I did find a little chart.
Oh my gosh.
on the molting periods. It's intricate though. I mean it's intricate, and a lot of times it can take months for the molt to be fully done, both with birds that lose their feathers sequentially, you know, who are still able to fly. That full body molt can take months for it to happen with the birds.
Wow. So the birds, I guess, do not have an internet section that says, time now, lose your primary feathers.
No email reminders for them.
So we have talked about what happens with a complete molt at the beginning. We've talked a little bit about how this works for waterfowl. Are there other birds in like a different pattern? I'm trying to visualize the little chart you have in front of you. So oh, Rome, good heavens, it's very complicated. Okay, so what happens if you don't fall into either of the categories we've just talked about, but you're still a bird? We've got to.
So there are a couple other types of molts. There are certain types of birds who go through one complete molt and one partial molt right before the breeding season.
Oh.
This is the molt by which birds replace only some and rarely all of their basic plumage feathers. This molt usually occurs before the breeding season and produces the bird's handsome breeding plumage during courtship and pair formation. The birds that are in this category tend to be like the tanagers and the warblers, who show up in their super bright colors when, usually in the spring when we start seeing them, they have gone through that partial molt to get their really bright, spiffy colors to attract mates on.
Okay.
Yep. And then these birds, too, before the next breeding season, they have a partial molt of their body feathers that gives that color. They will do it again. Females don't typically molt into bright plumage, you know, but they do go through this same partial molt as well.
Well, one of the things that we haven't really talked about at this point is the various reasons why you would need to replace a feather. It's worn out or it's frayed. And one of the things is that the females are, their federation, if we want to call it, helps them be less obvious. Once they're on a nest with fledglings, they do not really want to be seen brilliantly, unlike the male birds. And those particular birds, at any time of the year, you'd almost feel, gosh, I've seen that bird look like that all the time. Well, like a wren might not look different from winter to summer, but some of the birds then, we've got them going partially molted, and some of them, which, as you just mentioned, they might undergo two full molts a year, which seems like a biological impossibility. But there they are.
Who is our best example here of the two full molts per year are the goldfinch, the American goldfinch, who show up.
Okay.
They're sort of out of the norm. They're one of the few sort of songbird species that does this complete molt every year, two full molts, you know. And then there's also some birds too, who, because of the environments that they live in, do these same full molts as well. Marsh wrens are a great example of that. Those birds live in really reedy, abrasive vegetation. Like, they're moving through those reeds, they're moving through those grasses that are sort of tough, and their feathers get worn because of that.
Ah.
And so to keep them in top flight shape, to keep them warm, to keep them looking good for mates and all of that stuff, they do a complete molt two times a year as well.
Well, the interesting thing about goldfinches is when we visualize the goldfinch, what we're actually visualizing is the male goldfinch in its breeding plumage.
Yes.
That's what makes it a goldfinch. And I have noticed after watching them through the summer, they nest rather late and they haven't been back. But those brilliant males, I'm just not expecting to see them again until next spring. And in the meantime, yeah, they're busy.
They are very busy right now. They are our latest nesters on the peninsula. They are our latest nesting songbirds. So they're just sort of in full swing on nesting season. We've been seeing our first round of babies come out, and they tend to be sort of a drab, olive, greenish, yellow color, more similar to the females than the males.
Right. They look like their moms. Right?
Yes, absolutely.
So there are a couple more things that we, I think, can get in at this point. We talked a little bit about your feather wearing out or getting frayed. And in some cases, if you're a bird watcher, some birds take a long time to finish getting all of their adult plumage. Eagles, for example. How does that work? I mean, say I'm looking up, I'm seeing an eagle that might be 2 years old. It's not going to look like an adult eagle.
No, absolutely. Bald eagles take almost 5 years to reach adult plumage.
Wow.
4 to 5 years is very typical for bald eagles to reach that classic white head, white tail, dark body. And it takes them that long to reach maturity, to be ready to mate and physically and all of that stuff. So that is a signal to other birds as well that they are a viable partner to mate with.
Is that length of time one of the longest times it takes a bird to reach adult plumage? I mean, a lot of things can happen in 5 years that might make it not possible for that bird to actually grow up and stand there and be ready to breed after 5 years.
Absolutely. You know, I am not 100% sure about it being the longest bird to reach maturity. There may be others out there, but he's sort of our classic one that we all get to see. And you can see the stages of him too, which is really interesting. Like, most of the time, people who spend some time looking at birds can say, oh, you know, that's a three-year-old bird, because he's starting to get some of those characteristics of the adult, whereas like a first year juvenile, he's all brown. all brown, got a little bit of streaking on him, but and sometimes a little bit of lighter coloration underneath the wings. But for the most part, he's all streaky brown.
Well, the question of feathers and molting brings up for me the fact that bird watching, which is already not simple, gets a whole lot less simple when you have a bird like an eagle or a gull. Many of the gulls fiddle around for years too, don't they?
Absolutely. Gulls. And I think that if you spend some time, there's a learning curve to bird watching. Absolutely. You know, the more you look and the more you see, the more you learn. Gulls, they're not my strong point, but they definitely have distinct patterns. First year, second year, third year, fourth year gulls. Usually I think it's about 4 years for gulls to reach maturity as well. And they look distinctly different in those phases.
Wow.
So it's a great way for birders to sort of help identify what's going on.
Or like me, they can say, I'm giving up on gulls. I really like birds that live in conifers. Where are those birds? The gulls are really hard. So any of you listening who love watching gulls, you can watch them over a period of time and watch them change. In addition to the time it takes, some of these bird feather adaptions are about camouflage, right? And safety?
Yes, absolutely. Definitely camouflage and safety play into a lot of bird patterns on their feathers. I think that if birds are, you know, their feathers sort of get ratty and they aren't looking so good, they're not going to be as well camouflaged as they could be. Ptarmigans are an interesting bird to talk about for camouflage and safety. They molt into absolutely beautiful colors or to a beautiful white to match the sort of tundra habitat that they live in the winter. And then their camouflage season changes, where they replace the white feathers with brown ones when the snow cover recedes. And eventually they'll have a totally brown plumage in the warmer months to blend in with their surroundings.
Which brings up some questions that we all have about temperature changes and climate change, because that bird is adapted to become completely white at a certain point based on snow cover. And it's going to be something that we need to learn more about as to how does that bird react when the snow cover is later, or there's less of it, or whatever.
Absolutely. And their habitats may change. And then when those habitats change, they may be forced into different migration patterns. You know, it's definitely going to be interesting. Snowpacks are receding.
Sure.
You know, there's definitely a loss of tundra
right
out there. And so birds are definitely going to change. Another bird that's in that same kind of group that does that are snow buntings, which we see up here occasionally as well. I know Port Townsend has had quite a few sightings of snow buntings over the years that we've been in business out here. And it's always sort of something that sticks in my mind when someone does see them, because they're not super common, but they are one who change from white to brown as well to maintain their camouflage. When we talked about this sort of like idea of camouflage for birds earlier too, I thought of how interesting some birds are, like the female red-winged blackbirds. Those guys are perfectly camouflaged to be sitting in a nest and just look like part of the habitat. Those brown streaky feathers
sure.
on the females sort of mimic the reeds that they nest and hide in to help keep them safe.
Meanwhile, the male red-winged blackbird is a year-round brilliant. I mean, they have gorgeous shoulders. They have all those beautiful reds. Do they ever shift back to brown?
They don't shift back to brown, but those epaulettes, that's what they call those red patches on their shoulders, those get the bigger and the more brilliant that they can make those. And I think that happens, you know, right before mating as well. They will go through a molt, and the bigger and brighter that those epaulettes are, the more territory a red-winged blackbird can maintain.
Oh my
and
gosh.
And the greater his ability to attract females is too.
Okay.
And so the more successful birds are the ones that have the brighter plumage and the bigger epaulettes. And that's all
I'm wondering if a female red-winged blackbird, who is brown, is a little nearsighted. I'm very nearsighted. And I think if they were looking for something bright red and big, they might do better.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
So what we've got about molting is basically this is connected to time. It's connected to the change of seasons. And how else would you want to sort of summarize what's happening with birds molting and all of the varieties of things that can happen?
Well, I think that a big trigger for molting is the availability of food for birds.
Okay.
So having an abundant resource in the spring right before mating season happens helps those birds produce those feathers. They need protein sources to produce feathers. They need to be able to eat. And also, once they do produce those feathers and they can show their potential mates that they have, you know, that they're good at finding food, that they have abundant resources, they can be a good provider, it all sort of tells that to the other birds that are out there in nature. So it's definitely triggered by season. So right before they mate, everybody's got their spiffy clothes on. They've packed on the calories to produce those feathers and gotten the protein sources to make new ones. And then they go through mating and they expend all that energy. And that's a lot of wear and tear on birds, you know, building nests, defending territory,
sure,
laying eggs, raising chicks, feeding babies, getting babies to fledge. By the time that they're done with that, they're a little worn out. They're a little worn down. And then they've also throughout that season too, birds start catching food. So they've made some resources for themselves. Lots of the seeds are available in the fall for them to molt back into their basic plumage. And so they have those resources available to them. Again, they can go through another molt if they need to.
Oh my gosh.
And get ready for migration or surviving winter, you know, of having feathers in great shape to keep them warm.
I think this is one of the most interesting things about birds is the patterns that they go through that we don't observe being human. We have trouble just changing our clothes when they're already in the closet. So my goodness. So thank you, Christy. In about 2 weeks, we're going to do one more show about this topic, which is going to be exclusively about feathers. If you had to make a feather, how would you do it? How long have birds had feathers? Why is a down vest warmer than anything else? So about mid-September, we will get back with flying in with more feathers. Christy, thank you. It is always wonderful to have you here. We really appreciate it. Our mystery bird today is the harlequin duck. And the interesting thing about this bird is its scientific name has nothing to do with the characteristics of this duck. The scientific name is Histrionicus histrionicus. And you might go, huh? Hmm? What? Harlequin was a clown figure in early plays. And histrionical means dramatic. And it certainly applies to the appearance rather than the behavior of the harlequin duck, which is a coastal duck that swims underground. The drama is in its vivid beauty. The male harlequin duck has patterns as if drawn in paint. A blue body with black and white markings. Things outlined looked as if they're done with a paintbrush. They're russet on the head and russet underneath. And for your treat of the week, just look up a photo of a harlequin duck. The russet only shows when they're out of the water, and they do congregate on rocks. They're very active in water. They feed by diving underwater, propelling themselves by their feet, with their wings held sort of outstretched for steering, and their diving can be as deep as 70 feet, and it can last as long as 45 seconds. Quite amazing. They are monogamous. The female tends to the nest and to the fledglings, and only the female incubates the eggs while the male departs for what this writer said, the molting grounds along the coast soon after incubation begins. This was the only reference to molting ground that I found, but it seems to indicate that the ducks are gathering. The males are getting together saying, we're done with this breeding thing now. Let's hang out on the molting grounds and get some new feathers. They are generally not in much trouble as far as survival is concerned, but logging of the places where they breed can be a concern. And they're a coastal species, so harlequin ducks are susceptible to oil spills. And bioaccumulation of heavy metals from oil production can be a concern for sea ducks in general. The harlequin duck is an astonishing bird, and with if you just need to say, what's the genus? Histrionicus. Well, what's the species? Histrionicus. I think the person who did that had a lot of coffee to drink or a little too much wine, and they just said, oh, heck, we're going to just call it Histrionicus, Histrionicus. Thank you for joining us today for Nature Now, last week in August. Our song today is Bird on a Wire by Leonard Cohen, and it's wonderful to be able to listen to it, and even better, Nora Petrick, who is our engineer and keeps us going fabulously, says that she got to hear Leonard Cohen in London. I'm going to try to get her autograph before I leave the station here. That's pretty amazing. And thanks to Christy Lassen for looking up what happens when birds are losing their feathers. We'll be happy to join you again at Nature Now, and have a really
like
great day.
Like a bird on the wire, like a drone in an old midnight choir. I have tried in my way to be free, like a worm on a hook, like a knight bent down in some old-fashioned book. It was the shape of our love that twisted me. If I have been unkind, oh, if I have been unkind, I hope you can find a way if I have been untrue, if I have been untrue, it's just that I thought a liar, I thought a lover had to be some kind of liar too.
Dungeness River Nature Center is pleased to support KPTZ programming like Nature Now. In memory of Dee and Beverly Swearingen, who taught their children and grandchildren the love and stewardship of nature, Dungeness River Nature Center, teaching generations about nature on the Olympic Peninsula at Railroad Bridge Park in Squim. More at DungenessRiverCenter.org.